My name is Clemens. I work at Microsoft. I'm an architect in the Azure group. My team is in America. I work mostly out of my house in Germany. I'm very far out west, close to Holland. My hometown is Mönchengladbach. If you're familiar with football, that might, Borussia, exactly, that might ring a bell. So that's where I'm from. I'm going to talk about things and homes and cars and machines and factories and streets and generally the Internet of Things and the Internet of Things in a very real way, like how the Internet of Things is touching us today. And towards the end of this, I'm going to talk about technology that we built specifically for the Internet of Things. But generally, this talk is about scenarios, and I'm going to walk you through a lot of things that are being connected or that are being enhanced with digital technology. What I'm going to start with, because I'm German, is a Volkswagen Golf. It's a diesel, right? Before I do this, let me go and do one boring text slide. And the one boring text slide is about where I believe the money is in IoT. You hear a lot about IoT and about the toaster talking to the dishwasher and nonsense like that. And about people who are building these fabulous contraptions with Raspberry Pis and Arduinos. It's all wonderful. But these are things on the internet. It's not the Internet of Things that I'm going to talk about here. So where's the business opportunity for you and your companies, and your customers in the Internet of Things? And there's really just a few areas that are currently promising to really bring money. And I'm going to go through those along the line of examples. So this is the only boring text slide I'm going to put up. There's process optimization in industrial automation and logistics, making existing processes work better. There's energy management, renewables, e-mobility, we're going to talk about those. Environmental protection, security, and safety. And these are the areas where there's currently believed to be money in the Internet of Things, and there's also very interesting players, very interesting customer kinds that are not even on your radar. I don't think of the Internet of Things as being a hardware revolution or the rise of the Arduinos, but rather one that is about systems. So I'll talk about systems predominantly today. We'll start with this, and I'm going to make this a little bit more real, and I brought a video that we shot in Redmond. I'm going to give you a bit of a ride here. The ride is with Lars Eggenstein, who's from IAV. IAV is an engineering company, and the engineering company is bringing you active driver assistance systems or in safety systems like the ones you would find in a Volkswagen, or an Audi, or a BMW. So those are the guys who are building these radar control, distance sensor systems, and all those things. So we're going to take you on a ride with Lars. This is a highway going from Microsoft campus out to Bellevue. And you have Lars, who's still holding the wheel. Now he's taking the hands off the wheel. You heard about Tesla having this automated driving system. Well, this is the same thing here in the Volkswagen Golf, and those guys built it. So he has the hands off the wheel, and the car is driving by itself, and it's using sensors that it has in the car. And the sensors is a radar, and the other sensor is a camera, an optical camera. And they're using sensor fusion to kind of detect the lanes here, and then the car kind of steers automatically along those lanes and also detects vehicles. So what do you see here in that control instrument? Is it also has sensors to the side. So it says now it's safe to change the lane to the left, but it's not safe to change the lane to the right because there's traffic behind it. So you see that in the central cluster instrument. And if you want to go and change lanes, that's something that you have to indicate by yourself. You go and then tip the blinker. This was a little dirty, as you can tell. So you tip the blinker to the left, and then the car will go and turn. Or basically just change the lanes. What we're seeing as we're driving along, we're now going to start hitting traffic because this is the... So we're now coming from campus. We're This is in the afternoon at like 3, so the traffic is starting to build up towards Everett. And the car is doing this. So Lars is just sitting there with his hands free, and now we're driving onto traffic. And the car is doing the braking, so it's slowing down a little bit. And I have to tell you, sitting in this car where the car is driving itself is scary. You may know this when you are sitting right next to a driver in the passenger seat, and you don't trust that driver all that much. Like your spouse. And the car is doing it all by itself. It's keeping the lane. It's waiting. Lars is not doing anything here. And it's relying on these two sensors, as I mentioned. Those two sensors are production sensors as you find them today in the Volkswagen Golf. So the picture that I had up of that Golf, if you buy the luxury version, it has this distance radar control. So what they've done is they're repurposing the existing sensors, which cost about €350 total in bill of material cost, and they're using them for that experience. So it just this is how they drive in America. The truck is just parked in the middle of the road. So this is largely this clip. You see the car kind of steering all by itself. It swivels a little bit, but that's all. Lars is not doing anything. The car is just doing that all by itself. So this is an interesting experience here. This is the status quo today, and you will be able to buy this experience in vehicles. You know, Tesla started rolling this out now. You're going to see this in BMW, you're going to see this in Audis, you're going to see this in Daimlers. You're going to see this technology in street vehicles within the next 1 or 2 years. This is called highly automated driving. The tech press says we're going to have completely autonomous vehicles, right, in 2 years. By everybody who's in the automotive industry will say that is nonsense. That's not going to happen for reasons. Because this technology works really well when it's sunny, when there's no obstructions, when you have good sight and you have good vision, but it doesn't work so well when it's rainy and foggy and because the optical sensors don't work that well. So we need to make those things better. The famous Google car that everybody says, hey, that's going to be the future, is totally safe. They have now been rear-ended, without their fault, 45 times in their fleet. There is no fleet in the world of cars that is being rear-ended as much as the Google car. So something is not as safe as it could be, arguably. Yes, it might not always be their fault, but if you have a fleet of so many vehicles that get rear-ended that much, there's something wrong. Google depends on perfect maps. And you can't have a perfect map if you have a dynamic environment where things change all the time. And on our streets, things change all the time. So there's more that we need to do, and it has to do with the Internet of Things. This experience here is a self-contained experience, no maps whatsoever. The car just did it all by itself. But to make this better and to get us from the production-ready stuff that is here this year to the vision of completely driverless driving, where you can turn your back to the street in 10 years, requires a lot of digital technology and requires a lot of Internet of Things. So we'll talk about that. Before that, let me just, since we have a Volkswagen diesel here, let me talk about pollution quickly. What are the economic drivers for autonomous driving? And what are the economic drivers for a lot of the IoT, Internet of Things investments that we're going to see? As I said, safety, security, environmental protection, energy management, optimization. The way we can go and start financing a lot of those dreams of the Internet of Things is through public funds and through things that people really care about, and pollution is one of them. Pollution management is a clear thing. So cars are subject to pollution management, and there's these EU regulations around fine particle dust, and the way that Germany is solving that problem is every car has these colored stickers that you have to have in the vehicle. And those colored stickers are by the classification of that vehicle. And in certain cities, you can't drive if you have a car that's classified as with number one, so with red, or number two. And others, so, and kind of, you see around Stuttgart, right, you can only drive effectively with the newest vehicles so that they can keep pollution under check. They also do this dynamically, so some cities have just a general ban on unclean vehicles. Others do this dynamically. The way they do this dynamically is they measure the air quality. They measure the air quality, bring that together, analyze the air quality, and based on that, go and control how and which vehicles can be on the road. And they also go and start verifying this with traffic cameras, where they can go and do automated controls, because you can see that sticker. That's the Internet of Things. It's, you know, measurement in the world, interfacing, have a system that interfaces with the physical world, bring the data together, analyze, and then make decisions based on that for pollution control. We have some very interesting projects in Microsoft Research. One of them is New York City City Noise for the New York City 311 platform that we can go to here, City Noise, and you can go and read about this at Microsoft Research. And that's a noise pollution project that has microphones all through New York City and is measuring noise pollution so that the city of New York, the city of New York can go and manage that sort of pollution. We have another project, which is also very interesting, in Beijing, called Urban Air. And Beijing, as you all know, has horrible problems with air quality, and they're managing air quality by just shutting factories down, banning vehicles from the street. But you need to know all this. So again, you have a network of sensors that you're putting together. So here's urbanair.msra.cn, and that's the Chinese version, which hopefully loads. So that's the current air quality index in Beijing. I hope the map is going to load. The internet is a little bit slow. Imagine there's a map of Beijing behind this. There, here we go. And that's the current real-time air quality readings in Beijing. And if you're as familiar with Chinese as I am, here they are. So NO2 is kind of getting up there. And so that's air quality real-time information. Again, that's the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is about interfacing systems, interfacing with the real world to bring us real benefit. Let's get back to the autonomous vehicles. Autonomous vehicles are going to be very interesting when they once they come around and once that works. They're going to be a significant change to the way cars work, how the way traffic is being managed in cities. Once we are over the hump in about 10 years' time to have fully autonomous vehicles, that might just be the end of the normal, you know, run-of-the-mill simple vehicle that people buy because they just need to have a car, but they don't care about having a car. And there's a lot of those kinds of vehicles. If you look on the street, you can tell who hates driving and who likes driving by the kind of car that they buy. And there's going to be a significant impact. So let's go through the steps. So where we are today with all of those driving assistance systems is, if you're going to invest the money and it's going to cost you probably between 3,000 and 5,000 euros to buy the assistance package for a high-end car, for the car to have an experience as I just showed you, that is going to be within the next 1 or 2 years. In this setup, and with the Tesla that you can get now, where they're the first ones who ship this, you have to keep your hands on the wheel, effectively, or just buy it. The car will instantly go and throw control back to you if it doesn't know what to do. That's where we are today. So you have to be alert. It's a luxury feature, but it's not something that will drive you. And the risk here is, obviously, that people get lazy and the system works too well and they get, you know, not alert. So we're going to see how this all works. In 5 years, the belief is that you can give about 10 to 15 seconds warning from the car when the car drives into an area, like into an urban area, where it knows it can't go and do everything by itself, that it is going to give you control. So it gives you 10 to 15 seconds warning, and then otherwise you can go and watch a movie. In 10 years, you have to go. You can literally turn this, the back to the street. The question is whether we're going to go and trust it, because not all autonomous cars are good cars. Maybe we think so. No, I don't think so. Thank you very much, though. So autonomous driving. So autonomous driving is going to be an interesting. Might be an interesting change. Might be an interesting change because it will change the way how we think about city management in cities. And it's not so clear to me that autonomous electric vehicles, we're going to get to electric in a second, autonomous electric vehicles are going to take over the world in a way that it's going to be profitable for all the car manufacturers. I'm not so sure that entering the automobile market for a company like Apple, who apparently wants to do this, is going to be big business. If you can make a car, and that car can now go and drive itself, you can make a little cabin, and you can make very many of those little cabins, and you can just have them whiz down the street. Uber, those guys, are actually up to something that's very interesting, because they're managing, right now they need drivers, but they're clearly aiming for a time where they don't need drivers, and they're just whizzing around little cabins. Well, what does that mean to our existing transport systems? We currently have trams, and we have buses, and we have subways. The bus system hauls around big buses that have a capacity of 50 people who often go empty. If we can replace them by point-to-point little cabins that move around with four people each, that might just be a more efficient system, and they can go and go back and forth. I think we're going to go and see the eviction of standard vehicles out of the cities, in very many cities. And very many people will no longer need a car, and the car will become kind of a luxury gadget, the extra vehicle that you're going to have. But you're no longer going to go and depend on them. It's going to fundamentally change how we're going to go and do things. And it's all only possible because we're building the Internet of Things, because we're connecting everything. Today, you're buying a car based on your primary usage scenario, right? I have a family, and I need to have a van that needs to have a lot of capacity because I want to go and take my family out to sport on Saturday. Or I need to have a truck because I am hauling stuff for my hobby every once in a while. That's going to change because if you can summon a vehicle, if you basically can go to an app and say, I need to have a truck, and it takes 5 minutes and the truck rolls in front of your door, and then it can take you to wherever you want to go and do your hobby thing, and then it drives you back. Or you can go and take, you could, if you've done your business and you can summon a sports car to get home, maybe you no longer need your own truck, your own special purpose vehicle. Maybe you're going to have one fun car that you want to go and drive yourself, and self-driving will still exist. But all those utility vehicles are going to fundamentally change. And it's all enabled by digital technology, by communication. We're making that happen. You and me. So in the cities, there's a lot of traffic management happening already. So here's traffic management from the city of Düsseldorf. And they have statistics about traffic situation, current traffic jams, but also, and that's very important, construction sites. Where is a construction site? Where will a construction site be? They have information about special events. If there is a football game in the Esprit Arena in the north of Düsseldorf, if there's a concert in the ISS Dome, if there's a concert in the, whatever the other hall is called, that's all in the traffic management system. So they know. And so they can tell you. So if you're building a logistics routing application that routes a package service, or if you're routing taxis, if you're routing anybody, and you're building an app, you can build an app on top of this and take the data, which is public data, and use it for your own system. So the cities are starting to build these traffic information systems because they're interested in the traffic flow being okay inside of the city, because if you have constant traffic congestion in a city, it gives you bad marks as an administration. In Seattle, There's a wonderful app called One Buzz Away, and it's not only in Seattle, it's in multiple cities. And it's something that we are familiar with in Europe in many places, but in America, unfortunately, the public transport system is chronically underfunded. And so here, there's a collaboration of universities that kind of have a real-time application where all the buses today have sensor technology on them, and they also have beacons on them that tell you where that bus is at any point in time, because there's management of all these buses and when they arrive and where they are and what the traffic management is. So there's fleet management that all of those public transport companies do. And those guys take that data and just surface it up so you can exactly know when your bus is going to arrive in your app, which is really fabulous for a traffic system that is not as built out as you would expect it, for instance, in Europe. Again, it's taking public data from the metro system and builds an application that sits on top of this. Public transportation and cars are going to be increasingly electric, as the Tesla is electric. There's a problem, though, with becoming too utopian about this. I've had a conversation with a friend who's a venture capitalist in the Silicon Valley. He said, in 5 years, all cars that we're going to buy are going to be electric. As an exaggeration, you know, the development cycle for an electric car is between 5 and 7 years. So at this point, everything the manufacturers would have to do right now would have to be electric. Now, there's a problem with all cars being electric. If you measure how much energy is in a liter of gasoline, and you calculate how much energy is in a tank of gasoline, and you think about how many cars are on the street in the city, and you think about how much capacity there is in the electricity grid, it's not even close. It's impossible for the current electricity grid to be the fuel station for everybody. It doesn't work at all. We're several magnitudes off. There's so much energy sitting in fossil fuel, we can't do it with the electric grid. So that's the next challenge. The next challenge is how do we deal with energy? What's our story with energy in the future? How can we go and make that work? And the only way we can go and make that work is through the Internet of Things, through digital information, because we're going through a fundamental shift. The fundamental shift we're going through is that we are changing the way how electricity works, how the electricity grid works, for two reasons. First, we need to get the energy sources closer to the consumers. We have to do this. If we want to go and make the world electric, if we want to make cars electric, we need to go and produce energies basically close by to the fuel stations. The long haul grid will not be able to carry this, because we have to go and build new ones. We would have to go and build tenfold the capacity of high voltage transfer lines if we want to fuel all the cars there. And we no longer like fossil fuels for a reason, for pollution and for climate and for we're going to run out reasons. And we're not big fans of nuclear either, because of the long-term costs of that. So what we do is we move towards renewables, wind energy, sun. And what's interesting is that the projections currently are that between today and 2025, we're going to lose 60% of the fossil fuel power plant capacity in Europe, 60%. Across the continent, up to 60% of the fossil fuel power plant capacity is going to be lost. It's going to be replaced with renewables. And everybody goes, yay, fantastic. Except that there's events where that becomes a little bit difficult. This is the solar eclipse from March. This is from NSOE. NSOE is the European Central Association of Electricity Grid Operators. And so they have managed us actively through the solar eclipse from March, so that the grid didn't collapse throughout Europe. What this here is, what you're seeing here is a 30% capacity drop across Europe from the solar eclipse. The sun goes in, the moon goes in front of the sun, and you see how steep that is of a drop, and the capacity of the power generation capacity drops by 30% into a morning event, which electricity use rises throughout the day. So there's management here, and that management gets more complicated by the day. What they had to do for this event, and this is 2015, is they had to keep the coal and the oil and the nuclear plants that they have on standby. They had to fire them all up. And as the solar power and the wind power started dropping out, they had to go and run them up to keep the system up and stable. As the moon moved away from the sun, they had to go and power them down again. Highly coordinated effort. This works now, and this is and they're it's digital technology that makes that possible. Internet of Things. This is going to get harder and harder and harder the more we lose this fossil fuel capacity, where we can go and effectively backfill that the loss of instantly available technology. So there's ways to go and deal with that. And we're going to see more investments into this, and that's batteries. This is a battery. It's a battery. It's a hydroelectric power management system, effectively. Köpchenwerk in Germany has been built in the 1930s. And the way this works is there's a lake on top of that hill, and there's pumps down on that lake. And this thing gets power and pumps the water up the hill as a battery. And then when energy is needed, the water flows back down and generates the energy. So this is a battery system. So we'll see more and more of these that are going to be built in the Alps, that are going to be built in remote areas in Scandinavia. But it's a continental effort. And it requires that we are working together across the continent, and that's why N2E exists. And what we need to do is we need to go and connect all those things up. So there's messaging systems at the bottom of all this that kind of allow the communication to flow and to integrate this all. It's fascinating. It's not Arduinos and Raspberry Pis. Like, our infrastructure depends on digital technology to hang together and to coordinate these things. So there's a fascinating website that you can go and play with. It's called transparency.ntsoe.eu. So transparency.ntsoe.eu. That has effectively the entire statistics about the current load generation, the current load on the grid, information about what's currently going on in which countries. Let's go and go here. Okay. We'll give it a second. I hear some. So here's the actual generation per product type in Spain. So per, where that electricity comes from. The total load today, actual load, and the prediction for the rest of the day, Hungary, net positions, like Hungary is currently buying electricity, and here they're selling, the prices, price development, imbalance. So there's all kinds of statistics that are on this website. It's fascinating to look at and kind of gives you an insight into the whole balancing and the management of the grid across Europe. And it's all, and there's a whole messaging system that sits under the covers of this and kind of automates all that. Industrial automation is another area which is where the Internet of Things has been happening for the last 40 years. The first digital controllers in factories showed up in the late 60s. And since then, digital has been part of factory automation for the whole time. And when you walk up to industrial automation folks and say, the Internet of Things has arrived, they're like, how is that new? So I happen to be on the OPC Foundation Technical Advisory Council, also a member of the working group about OPC UA. OPC is a standard for making factory devices, process controllers, sensors, all kinds of machines, big and small, communicate with each other. So here this is a production line, and the production line is a bottling production line. And that bottling production line starts with, you know, here at this point, putting the bottles up here. And these are PET bottles, which are either being loaded up from return, so they're being returned. And so they're either being loaded up that way, or they're being actually newly produced. They're being washed. Then they're being filled. Then they run and cool off, and then go into the packaging system over here. So that's an integrated thing. Inside of those machines, like the filling apparatus that's going to fill the bottles up, that's a real-time bus system. That happens on, and real-time systems in manufacturing are happening in microseconds. And real-time means, if you say two microseconds, you mean 2 microseconds. You don't mean 1.8 microseconds. You don't mean 2.2 microseconds. You mean 2 microseconds. That's real-time. Real-time means real predictability. That's something you do with a real-time bus. There's an Ethernet, like something that we believe is the grail of everything, isn't even in that area yet. So there's standards like EtherCAT, and there's now work that being done in IEEE on time-sensitive networking to make that predictable, but that's work that's currently being done right now. The integration, though, between all those systems and the integration with the rest of the world and being able to go and make a dashboard like this and have an integrated view of this factory here with, you know, across many factories, that's something that doesn't happen in real time, in hard real time, industrial real time. It happens fast, but not in predictable real time. So that's the trend that's currently happening in industrial automation. Industrial automation, what digital technology has done so far, it has dealt with the islands that are these individual machines, but not so much with stringing them all together into one coherent system, and not with stringing them together with the IT system that says we're going to produce 500,000 bottles today, and we're going to do the following thing. So these are all, like, to integrate all of this is something that is IT, OT, convergence, as we call it, and that's the topic kind of what we call Industry 4.0, or what's being called the Industrial Internet, to go and string those things all together and to integrate them with IT systems. That's the current trend that we have, bringing this technology together with the IT technology and also allow it to go to kind of bridge these systems across boundaries and borders. If you're a manufacturer like Krones here, or if you're, you know, creating any kind of industrial machines, you will sell them around the world. Germany is good at this. Sweden is good at this. Poland is also good at this. And what you want to avoid is that if someone in China flips the wrong switch, you have to go and send someone with a plane to China to unflip that switch. So it's desirable to have remote servicing capabilities. And again, that is the Internet of Things. We know how to manage phones, and we know how to manage PCs. What we're learning now and what we're teaching each other, the industrial folks and the IT folks, is how to go and make any arbitrary machine remote manageable, just like a phone, just like a PC, even though they are not as standardized. And then we get into the house, and there's also automation. And what's interesting about that sort of automation is where's the money? So here's a thermostat from Honeywell, and everybody in all of their Internet of Things presentations obviously shows the thing that the Google guys bought, the Nest thermostat, as the poster child of the Internet of Things. The Nest thermostat has actually great breeding ground in the U.S. because the U.S. heating systems, like the one that I had in my house when I lived over there, was 1940s technology. And I had actually no thermostat to speak of, except of a rarely old one. And now I have a, you know, current heating system that was built 10 years ago. I don't need any of these things. Like, I don't even think about heating because I have a European standard, you know, highly automated thing that I push a button when I turn the heating on, and I never think about this thing again. But that didn't exist in my American house, so I would have appreciated to have these wonderful one of those wonderful Nest thermostats, or even one of those, like an extra aftermarket extra thermostat. But that's the poster child for these things. What's interesting is that the same guys actually also built a smoke detector. And the smoke detector is a very interesting device, because the smoke detector is a device that is motivating a lot of the investment in smart home and smart home automation. And when you look around, there's an interesting band of people who are trying to sell you home automation systems. In Germany, you can now buy home automation systems branded by insurance companies. Is that a surprise? No. Because this is about safety. Safety sells product. Safety sells the consumer Internet of Things, and we'll sell it for the foreseeable future. An insurance is a casino, and the insurance is doing bets, and they're going to bet against certain risks. If they can help reducing, so if I sell you fire insurance for X amount of money, there is an existing risk that your house is going to be on fire, and that's the bet that I'm betting that your house is not going to be on fire. But there's a certain percentage of houses that are going to go and burn down. That's how I calculate my premium. If I can manage to reduce that risk while keeping the premium stable, I make more money. So I'm going to encourage you to get smoke detectors so that your house is not going to burn down, but you're going to detect this early. Or better, even that the fire truck arrives at your house even if there's nobody in the house, so I don't have to pay for your house when that burns down. So me as an insurance, I'm interested in this. I'm interested in automated driving because the promise of automated driving is not that it's more convenient. The promise of automated driving is that we're going to get to, and this is the vision, that we're going to get to zero vehicle-related traffic deaths, that the car will effectively not kill anybody anymore because the car is going to take over and the car is going to make sure that nobody gets killed. That's the vision we're going to get, but the goal is to approximate this. But insurances are really, really interested in this because they want to reduce the rate, they want to reduce the risk overall. They also want to reduce the premiums, but ultimately they want to go and make more money. So safety is a huge driver for all those things. Having fewer burning buildings means fewer people who die from burning buildings. That's good for the city. Fewer damages to neighboring houses through burning buildings, which is also good for the city. All of that is also good for the insurances. So cities are interested in safety. Insurances are interested in safety. You're interested in safety. Safety is going to drive a lot of the investment of the Internet of Things. And a lot of investment is being brought into safety and into securing assets. So here's a German service, pegelonline.wsv.de. This is about the Elbe River, you know, how the water is in the Elbe. And of course, you want to know whether there is high water coming so you can go and secure your assets and move them on the side, so to avoid more flood damage than what's actually necessary. Here's the USGS water, real-time water stream flow data, so that's the equivalent thing in the United States. There's obviously earthquake information, real-time earthquake information. All public services, public data sources that are being measured, you know, measurements are being made, you can go and see all that information online, and you can tap, and you can also build applications on top of that if you like. Obviously, maps for routing traffic. And here's something that's super cool, something that I show you because you will be interested in this personally, and this is fabulous to go and play with. So we're going to go and take a look at this. This is lightningmaps.org. And you see that there's lightning strikes in near Palermo right now. So there's a thunderstorm over here. What this gives you is a real-time map of the world, effectively, with lightning strike sensors. So if you want to know whether bad weather is coming, go and look at the site, and it's telling you where that storm is. There's actually a thunder. There's a thunder indicator here as well. If you go very close, let's go and try this. I should wear my glasses, really. Let's see. Come on. Now I'm waiting. We're waiting for lightnings to strike in Palermo. So there were lightning strikes. So this is live data, right? I'm just speculating on lightning to strike. Oh, there is one. So this is the thunder. And when there's lightning right next around where you are, you can trust this thing, and the thunder will actually arrive around that time when it's indicated here. Like it says 3 second delay here. This is the German version, and it's accurate. Like it will say, like 3 seconds before this wave hits you, you'll hear the thunder. It's amazing, and it's done through a network of sensors. You can actually participate in this project that is wiring up the world, so you have a early warning system. It's fabulous. That's a real Internet of Things application. And of course, there's flight radar, which you maybe will be familiar with. That's a giant map of the world. Do I have that activated? So that's a map of the world, effectively, which has all of the world's aircraft that are emitting ADS-B signals, which are being picked up by radio stations, and kind of create this map. And that's an effort that I'm participating in on another site that's called FlightAware. So this is where I'm at here. So I'm off kind of from Düsseldorf. And I'm feeding data into this network. This is my Raspberry Pi. And the Raspberry Pi is looking around. I have the antenna on the roof, and I'm getting ADS-B data. So these are digital signals that all the aircraft emit. And I'm catching them. And today I've caught, yesterday I caught 5,580 planes and 355,000 position signals is what I reported into FlightAware from my house. And that's effectively an air traffic surveillance system, and it also helps with planning, it helps with noise pollution evaluation, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm donating, I basically just put that up on the roof, and I'm donating that into a number of sites. Again, Internet of Things in real. Marine traffic is a similar thing. I can't feed this because I'm not near water. Marine traffic is something that's very similar for marine ships using AIS signals. So that gets me to, what does that get us? Where do we get? Where do we get to? A model of digital infrastructure, an architecture of the world, effectively. We have civilizatory infrastructure, water, gas, electricity, waste, roads, rails, airways, ports. I have a bunch of them. I explained a lot of them already. And then we have the elements that we have. We observe all of them. We catalog them. We give you real-time information. We, as an industry, give people real-time information. We can go and control some of those things. We can have historical records that we can go and tap, and we can run machine learning algorithms over them to predict what's going to happen in the future. We have real-time information, real-time observations on which we can react, and then obviously the prediction comes out of the historical record where we can go and score current events. And on top of that, we can build platform solutions, and ultimately we can build client and consumer applications. And that's something that's starting to grow, but there's work to be done. Also because right now, none of those things are standardized. What I just showed you is a potpourri of all kinds of solutions where standardization isn't really happening yet, except in the case of NSOE, where the entire grid system, that's a standardized thing, and they'll keep working on standardization. But a lot of the other solutions are really island solutions. So we're going to be, as we talk about standardization in the Internet of Things, when people talk about this, like, oh, standards, and we have a good set of standards at the bottom of it, like application-level protocols. There's CoAP, MQTT, AMQP, HTTP, done. We don't need more. And that's kind of the set of protocols we're kind of settling on, it seems like. But What we need is we need to have harmonization of data, and that's something that's going to take a while. This is Germany in 1648, and you'll see Poland is kind of off to the side of here, over here, but that's kind of how data looks like today. In like every city has its own thing, and every state has its own thing, and this is what the situation looks like, and that's kind of sad. And that's not only in Germany, but that's all across Europe. And so standardization of actually the data sources, that's a thing. So there's actually now opportunity for people to go and embrace the fact that there's 500 different ways of expressing a thing and create a unified platform that goes and just basically taps all the sources that exist. Not wait for standardization, but go and proactively do the harmonization. So that happens by commercial services basically just pulling from all those different sources, collecting the information, normalizing the information, enriching with other sources, and then distribute it out. So that's, for instance, what Google does with traffic. That's what Nokia here does. That's where what TomTom does is they take a diverse set of sources, pull them all together, and kind of resell that data then to your navigation system that you use in your car at enormously high scale. So we see information brokers coming up for the Internet of Things who take all that information and put that all together and make it interesting. And of course, all of the stuff that I'm talking about so far needs to scale as we get into commercial products. We have cars here as an example. When you think about the connected car, which everybody is suddenly into, right? Everybody does the connected car and talks about the connected car, and I see this everywhere, and then people go and make a Raspberry Pi and plug it into the OBD port and then say, hey, I have a connected car solution. All those things need to scale to production. A car manufacturer makes 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million cars a year. If you build a system, that needs to scale with that manufacturer, or it needs to scale with the infrastructure. If you make an industrial pump, that industrial pump is being produced 1 million, 2 million, 3 million times a year. When you're building digital products and digital infrastructure, you have to scale to those numbers. Today, as people who are building enterprise application solutions, we're proud to have systems that scale to 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people. If we're building web apps, we're proud to have 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 concurrent sessions on our websites. But this here is concurrent use of actual devices out in the world, in physical space, in the millions. That's a wholly different story in terms of throughput, in terms of data that's being managed. So there's some requirements on IoT architecture. We need to handle extreme hardware and software heterogeneity. It's not all one operating system. We need to have lower barriers to entry. We need to support all kinds of different cloud environments for different users. So that led us to build platform for it. So we have a reference architecture in Azure to deal with systems of that scale and to address kind of these sort of challenges of both digital infrastructure and digital products. One of the things we embrace on the left side from devices and data sources is that there are a lot of kinds of devices. There's devices which speak IP and which will be attached to IP networks directly. There's a lot of devices which will not speak IP, but which are kind of low-power devices that are going to be talking through gateways. So a gateway that helps them communicate out to the cloud. All of the scenarios that I talked about today, so far, are all going to benefit from centralized intelligence, because they're all about consolidating information in the cloud or taking consolidated information from the cloud and use it. Even the car. The car we've seen is driving all by itself without extra data. But to take the next step to make it drive autonomously, it will have to have external information. So those systems, all of those systems I talked about today, are using centralized information. They're all cloud-based systems. So the devices sit on the left side, and they might go through a gateway. They're going to hook up to the cloud, and then there's effectively several paths of how we're going to deal with all those, and I have this a little bit simplified here. So we have different devices, And in Azure, we think about devices as not Windows, but really as anything that you can get your hands on. And that's also what we build our libraries for. So we build our libraries in C. We build libraries in Java. We're building them all truly cross-platform. Yes, we have Windows, but it's just one operating system. And we hooked them up to a field gateway. We have a protocol adapter notion. We currently ship one of those protocol adapter gateways, and I have that here as open source. Here's the IoT protocol gateway. That's our Git repo. And that protocol gateway is written in C#. It supports the MQTT protocol initially, but it's built so you can go and plug your own protocols, whatever protocols you have, into that gateway. Because we know that there's a ton of existing devices with existing standards, and we can't support them all in the core system, so we have this protocol gateway in front of it. The cloud gateway is built to scale, and to scale to as many devices as the customer has. So the cloud gateway, we have two versions of this. One is Event Hubs, the other one's IoT Hub. Event Hubs is for putting telemetry into the cloud, and it supports 1 GB/s in throughput, if you built the maximum Event Hub, from a million sources concurrent. IoT Hub allows you to do bidirectional communication with as many devices. It's currently in preview. Once it's finished, in GA, it's going to support way more than a million concurrent connected devices. So we're building this infrastructure to scale up to the needs of the infrastructure that I just talked about, including vehicles, including products. At the back of this, we have multiple paths for what to do with that data that comes in. One is batch analytics. So you play the telemetry into a database, and now you deal with that in a database way. You do Hadoop, or you do visualizations. You run it through Azure ML. You train models using it. And then there's hot path analytics, where you want to have answers right now. You want to know how many cars are on that road right now. You want to do and make a prediction of whether there's a traffic jam ahead of you, which means you need to go and evaluate the data in real time right now so you can see that 2 kilometers ahead of you, there's a traffic jam forming and people are hitting the brake lights over there, so you can go and slow down or you can possibly take the exit. That's all done through using real-time analytics. So Azure Stream Analytics and Azure Storm, part of the Hadoop package, they're doing that. And of course, there's Hotpath business logic, basically putting your own code into the fire hose of data using the Actor framework on Service Fabric. So that's another piece. So we're building, what you're seeing is we're building specific infrastructure to deal with security and to deal with scale, kind of stores those devices. And then we're tailoring the rest of the platform towards those solutions. But the IoT platform at Microsoft is called Azure. It's the entirety of the platform, because for all of those solutions and for all of those challenges that I talked about so far, you need to have the whole breadth of the platform. You need to integrate with all of those systems. So we're not making a little box. We're saying you need all of the cloud to go and build these kinds of systems. So Event Hubs, that I mentioned that. That is the high-scale ingest capability. Do I have the... I don't. Wait, hang on. Let me see whether I had the number slide. I don't have the number slide. I'm going to talk about this quickly. So it's also fine on time. Event Hubs is, as I said, the ingest capability. It works like a queue from the front, so you can go and send data into it using HTTP or the AMQP protocol. From the back, it works like effectively like a database or like a tape, if you will. So you can go and walk up to the Event Hub, and you can go to the beginning of time or a certain timestamp and start rolling the data out. And you can basically go and query in steps. You can go and pull the data out. This is natively integrated directly with Stream Analytics. So you can go and create an Event Hub, and you can put Stream Analytics at the back of it, and there's an automatic evaluation pipeline that's being formed out of this. Just a few numbers. Azure Event Hubs today processes 1.5 trillion messages per month. 1.5 trillion messages per month. Okay? Million, billion, trillion. Large number. That amounts to 12 petabyte of data per month. There's an enormous, and it's enormously rising. We're seeing growth rates that are really spectacular, and it's double digits per month that we have in growth rates in terms of telemetry being pushed in. The new thing we have following this is the IoT Hub that I just spoke about. An IoT Hub is something that's currently in preview. And what IoT Hub does is it gives you the ability to go and talk to the devices bidirectionally and send commands to them, pull telemetry out, and then route that telemetry down to the hot path, cold path analytics, etc. And with that, with the reference architecture, you can go and put together some solutions. And so one of those solutions is here. This is fabulous. I hope this works now. Great. So this is the IoT suite. And this is the asset management solution inside of the IoT suite. You can go to Azure IoT, I think it's called azureiotsuite.com, and you can go and create yourself one of those suites. And be warned, that's not free. It's actually costing money to run one of those. What this does, what the Azure IoT suite is, it is effectively the realization of that reference architecture as an ARM template. So Azure has these resource manager templates, effectively, which allows you to go and put resources together. And it will go and deploy an app. This app here, which is effectively an implementation of the reference architecture, is existing right here. So this sits on GitHub, the entire solution. And what we do from the portal is we go and deploy you one of those. So we go and deploy a DocumentDB, we deploy an IoT Hub, we deploy all the assets, including business logic and everything. We deploy them all for you, and you have a ready-to-use asset management solution that you can go and that you could leverage. But that's not the point. The point is that we're going to give you that code. We show you how to go and stand those things up. So this is your starting point for building your own solutions on top of the suite. So the suite is the entirety of all Azure services put together specifically with a focus on IoT. That's what this is about, with the core piece being the IoT Hub as the communication mechanism to and from the devices or the gateways. And then we're pulling together all the rest of it into a coherent application that you can use as a starting point. We're going to have starting points for asset management. We're going to have starting points for remote monitoring and for predictive maintenance that you can then go and start off and then build solutions on top of. Or you can go and build your entirely new solutions on top of the IoT suite. And what we're also going to have, and that's something that's currently not in the preview, is we will have management capabilities, so we'll be able to go and do effectively device management also through IoT Hub at the IoT Hub scale. So that's what I had for you today, a grand tour of the Internet of Things as it exists today. Many, many, many different use cases. There's a lot of data out there already. People are doing a lot of very interesting things, not only with Raspberry Pi, but really for our benefit in the world today. We're going to make the civilizatory infrastructure. We're going to make products at large scale a lot better. And we hope we can go and contribute to this with the high-scale cloud services that we built. And that's what I had to tell you. And with that, thank you very much.